Just to clarify before the, is it Ms. Newman?
Yes.
Yeah, good morning. So you have 10 minutes. Then we'll hear from the state. Then your co-counsel has 5 minutes for rebuttal, and we have a hard division of time there. And then because of the cross-appeal, the state will then have rebuttal limited to the cross-appeal issues, not a sur rebuttal on the principal appeal. So with that, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Brooke Newman from Pepperdine Law School, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Paulo. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of time as stated for my colleague's rebuttal. This case concerns Mr. Paulo's inability to exercise outdoors and to practice his religion. Despite clear Ninth Circuit precedent, prison officials have repeatedly violated these rights. Regarding Mr. Paulo's Eighth Amendment claim, the law of this circuit is that administrative exhaustion is measured from the date that an amended complaint is tendered to the district court. Under the Ninth Circuit's decision in Sadezai versus Davis, so long as a prisoner exhausts their administrative remedies before tendering an amended complaint to the district court, then they have properly exhausted.
I think you're correctly characterizing what our cases say. Let me tell you what concerns me about that principle and see if you can respond to it. Not this case, so you don't have to tell me that this didn't happen here. Somebody files a lawsuit and they have done nothing to exhaust on a claim. And then they file an amended complaint, which repeats the very claim that they failed to exhaust on, and adds another one on which they did exhaust. Is it time to exhaust the first claim, start all over again?
Under Sadezai, it would, Your Honor.
I understand that's what our cases say. It strikes me as sort of a strange rule. If it's exactly the same claim that you made in your original complaint, and assuming you failed to exhaust that and you have no excuse for it, your time to exhaust gets reinstated?
It's not strange under the federal rules of civil procedure because you are adding new facts for administrative exhaustion, which isn't
affirmative. But they're really not here with respect to your Eighth Amendment claim. Your Eighth Amendment, your Eighth Amendment claim in your operative complaint is precisely the same one as in your original complaint. You've added a free exercise claim, and nobody's fighting about whether that's exhausted here.
Apologies, Your Honor.
So I'm trying to figure. I think the case law says what you say it does. It just strikes me as a strange result that somebody can repeat exactly the same claim in the second complaint, add another one that he has exhausted, and get out of the exhaustion requirement as to the first one.
We respectfully disagree that it is the exact same claim because he added an additional party, and he also added additional facts to show he was denied outdoor exercise for a more continual period of time. So he added additional facts showing the deprivations continued for a longer period of time and that they actually worsened and that they involved more defendants. So while it has the same root of the Eighth Amendment claim, just like Sadezai with the excessive force claim, he did add new facts.
Now, let me ask you one other question about that. It was the grievance with respect to the additional claim, the embellished claim, if you would, gets filed significantly after the time that the events were supposed to have happened. Could the prison officials have turned it down as untimely?
My understanding is that he complied with the prison's grievance procedures in filing that second grievance, so my understanding is they could not have turned it down.
Well, but I mean, had they, we'd have a different case. Your argument is that he doesn't have to exhaust because they didn't respond to it. Had they responded to it, we'd have to figure out whether or not their response was meant that he had failed to exhaust.
No, Your Honor. If I'm understanding your question correctly, had the prison timely responded to Paulo's grievance, then he would have properly exhausted under the prison's administrative regulations.
Well, if the prison's timely response was your grievance is too late, you filed it too late because the events you're grieving about occurred in the distant past, then would he have exhausted?
If the prison had a regulation to that effect...
Yes.
So assuming that the prison regulation said you had to file it within a certain time and he didn't, then the prison regulation would control in that instance. But
okay.
I don't think we have that issue here, which apologies if I'm not answering your question correctly
on
that point.
You have.
Perfect. But that's why we respectfully ask this court to look at the facts we alleged in our brief, which is that Mr. Paulo properly exhausted by August 3rd, He subsequently tendered an amended complaint to the district court on August 10th, and thus he properly exhausted under Satisai. At the very least, we do allege in our brief that Mr. Apollo was thwarted in his efforts to exhaust his administrative remedies, and we have three arguments to that effect if the court is willing to hear those. First, under this court decision in Andres versus Marshall, failure to timely process a prisoner's grievance in prison constitutes exhaustion and even more so thwarting. And here, the prison's own regulations, which we used to determine when a response was due, required a response by August 1st. However, prison officials belatedly responded on October 13th, thus failing to timely process this grievance under Ninth Circuit precedent and thwarting his efforts. Additionally, Paulo alleged in his verified complaint that prison officials lost critical documents necessary for his administrative appeal, but then penalized him for failure to attach those documents. The district court incorrectly discredited Paulo's testimony on this point, finding his contention was, quote, unlikely. Meanwhile, the defendants offered no countervailing evidence. They simply asserted Paulo did not follow the proper procedures, and that conflicting issue of material fact should not have been resolved on summary judgment.
So can I ask, supposing that we agree with you on exhaustion, if we were to remand on that basis, the defendants will then immediately move for summary judgment on the basis of qualified immunity, and they will say that taking the facts in the light most favorable to you or to your client, that you know he was deprived of outdoor exercise for a period of time, but he also had at least some degree of indoor exercise and recreation opportunities. And what is the case that clearly establishes that as an Eighth Amendment violation?
Yes, Your Honors, that case is Allen versus Sakai, in which this court reversed the district court's denial of summary judgment and held that an Eighth Amendment violation occurred and the prison officials were not entitled to qualified immunity specifically when they only allowed a prisoner 45 minutes of outdoor exercise over the course of 6 weeks.
But since Allen, we've clarified in Norbert that deprivation of outdoor exercise is not per se unconstitutional. Like if you have that you can't look just at you know how much outdoor exercise time was there. You have to assess you know were there indoor recreation opportunities. So don't we have to look that we can't stop just by saying there wasn't outdoor exercise. We have to look at the indoor part too, don't we?
Under Norbert, we do, but Norbert could not have overturned longstanding Ninth Circuit precedent acknowledging the right to exercise outdoors. And so looking at this meaningful recreational opportunity under Norbert, we see on page 929 of that decision that the long-term denial of outdoor exercise is unconstitutional. Norbert quotes that. So it can't change that fundamental proposition. And the facts we have in Norbert are wildly different, Your Honors, because there's no dispute that the prisoners actually received 3.5 hours of dedicated exercise time every week in a ventilated, skylit rotunda equipped with gym equipment. In addition to that dedicated time, they also received 4.5 to 8 hours of out-of-cell time every single day, which allowed them to also use the time in the gym. And that's wildly different than the facts we have here, Your Honors, because Paulo only received 1 to 2.5 hours of out-of-cell time a day at any given time, depending on the prison's schedule. That included his time to use the restroom, attend chapel, meals, visitation, education, exercise, etc. And then, for the longest period of time, he only received 2 concurrent hours of gym and yard time, and he actually really never received that time. And so in Norbert, it was not disputed that they actually received far more time, and in Paulo's case, he actually did not receive that time, and it's disputed. So we would direct the court that that is the difference between Norbert, and that relying on Norbert for the proposition that there's no right to outdoor exercise in the Ninth Circuit is incorrect because the court can't change an earlier proposition that there is. Norbert was a very limited factual scenario where the prisoners received equivalent to outdoor exercise opportunities in a very sophisticated prison setting that we don't have here. And I see my time is running low, so I will briefly address the free exercise and our LUPA claims here as well. Our position is that on Paulo's religious liberty claims, the defendants do not have a basis to challenge the district court's RLUPA ruling. Specifically, at page 1018 through 1019 at 5 ER, the defendant's notice of appeal is limited to qualified immunity. And the Supreme Court made very clear in Ashcroft versus Al-Keed that qualified immunity shields state officials from money damages in their individual capacities.
So you didn't brief the question of whether the cross appeal was timely. Do you have a do you have a view on that? Have you taken a position on that?
We did not brief that issue, Your Honor. I know that the court heard oral argument to that effect last month, and that whether or not an interlocutory appeal is a judgment for purposes of Rule 58 and Rule 54. This court has not decided that issue. The Fifth Circuit has decided that issue, and so if the court aligned with the Fifth Circuit, their appeal would be timely, and we would not have a jurisdictional issue on that front. However, if the court disagreed that an interlocutory appeal was a judgment for those purposes, then there could potentially be a jurisdictional issue.
We're not the panel that's going to decide that other case, but what's your view?
Very, very interesting questions, Your Honor. Because I did not brief it, I do not want to risk giving this court an extremely uneducated view.
That's fair.
I apologize to evade the question. I never want to evade a question.
It's jurisdictional, that's why.
Yeah. Well, or is it jurisdictional?
Potentially jurisdictional.
It might be jurisdictional, but I take it. You haven't taken a position on whether it is or isn't, but... Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors. I apologize.
No, that's fine.
I see my time is running low, but as we've discussed, Paulo is not seeking monetary damages on his RLUIPA claim. He is only seeking injunctive relief, and so the district court's RLUIPA judgment must stand. There is no qualified immunity defense to that claim.
Okay.
The only issue...
You're actually a little bit over, so if you can wrap up very briefly and then...
I apologize, Your Honors. The only remaining issue that my co-counsel will likely address on rebuttal is whether or not the defendants are entitled to qualified immunity on Paulo's free exercise claim, because damages remain to be tried on that claim. And we reserve the rest of our time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to address my arguments to the panel. While the district court properly granted defendant's motion for summary judgment with respect to Paulo's outdoor exercise claim, the district court erred when denying defendant's motion for summary judgment with respect to Paulo's free First Amendment and RLUIPA claims because Paulo was seeking a kosher diet, which he admits does not comport with his religious beliefs. I will first address the religious diet claims, and then I will address the outdoor exercise claims, if that's okay with Your Honor.
Do you agree that whether or not the religious diet claims are appropriately in front of us will depend on the court's decision in another case?
You mean with respect to timeliness?
Yes.
Yeah, it would definitely depend on that, whether or not it's timely. The only timeliness we have is because there was no second document filed, and therefore no judgment under the plain language of the rule. And I want to stress that. That's the plain language of the rule, which this court is required to follow under the Supreme Court precedent. Then it is timely. And we have two circuit court cases.
Your quarrel will be with someone else, I think.
You're right. My quarrel is with Judge Rawlinson, who I used to clerk for. So,
well, the McNeil panel is going to resolve that question, it is before McNeil, before that panel. And my question is, the question in McNeil is the, as you are aware, when the time starts to run, when there isn't a separate document. But my question is that time limit a jurisdictional requirement when it's a cross appeal? Is the timely filing of a notice of cross appeal a jurisdictional requirement?
Okay, because the thing is that there's an additional rule for that gives you additional time for a cross.
No. I'm not asking about what the time limit is. The McNeil will decide whether it's timely or not. My question is, the timeliness of an appeal in a civil case is jurisdictional. Like Section 2107 and Bowles against Russell. Is the timeliness of a notice of cross appeal a jurisdictional requirement?
You know, I haven't considered that argument, Your Honor. Just to be honest, I assumed that it was when I was doing my briefing, and so that's why I didn't address that. So that's an interesting argument, and if Your Honor would like, I could look into that for you and brief it. But I don't think.
Well, assuming we get to the merits,
of
the religious claim,
right.
Tell me why the district court erred.
Well, because first, Chapman Calderon is entitled to qualified immunity with respect to the First Amendment claim.
Well, but the district court never got to. Did the district court reject a qualified immunity?
They didn't.
See, and that's
the thing is,
you're sort of asking us to to do the district court's work on this one.
Well, no, I'm asking you to review this de novo like you're entitled to do because the district court didn't do what they were supposed to do. I mean, you're entitled.
That's what happens when you ask.
That's why it's up on appeal. Is because the district court didn't do. But that doesn't mean you're out of the obligation.
Let me ask the question in a less pejorative fashion.
Okay.
Shouldn't we have the district court address qualified immunity in the first instance?
No, Your Honor, because qualified immunity is the right to be relieved from the burden of litigation. I think that you have an obligation to grant us qualified immunity if the court, as a matter of law, we are entitled to it. Because we're giving it back to it, then what it does, what you're doing is you're depriving us of the qualified immunity we're entitled to.
Well, no, I mean, I took the point of the question to be not that we would send it back for trial, but that we'd send it back for the district court to assess qualified immunity, and that doesn't deprive you of qualified immunity.
No, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. Qualified immunity is to be relieved from the burdens of litigation, all litigation. That's why you can assert qualified immunity at the motion to dismiss stage. That's why you don't have to go through discovery. When you're asserting qualified immunity at the motion to dismiss stage, because the Supreme Court is clear that it's to be relieved from all burdens of litigation.
Is there a Supreme Court case that says that when a case is up on appeal on an issue other than qualified immunity, and the district court hasn't yet ruled on qualified immunity, that the Court of Appeals must consider it in the first instance rather than leaving it for remand?
I don't know if they've addressed that issue specifically.
I don't think
they have. But they have addressed it. They have specifically addressed it, saying that we're entitled to relief from burdens of all litigation, not just part of the litigation. We're not just going backwards. And I think that's a thing that we need to do with these qualified immunity cases, because it is immunity, and so we shouldn't be pushing it off and say, well, just because we're going to have to make you go back to the district court, because this is a de novo review. If it wasn't a de novo review and there weren't fact-finding issues, if there were fact-finding issues involved, I would say yeah. Okay. For example, if you say, you know, going back to trial. But the thing is, it's a de novo review. You're doing the exact same review that the district court is supposed to do. And so if you're not taking that obligation seriously, that we're entitled to be free from these litigations, I think would be a mistake, Your Honor.
Assuming for a moment that we don't want to take up qualified immunity, can you address why the district court erred in not granting summary judgment? In other words, that should we, assuming this all shows up in front of us and we say we're not going to take up qualified immunity, tell me why the district court erred in its
ruling. Because qualified immunity has the two obligations, so you...
No, I'm stopping. Stop. Assume for a moment we're not going to take up qualified immunity.
Okay. But what I'm asking, Your Honor, then, is that you're saying that whether or not we are violating clearly, we're violating the law?
No, I'm asking you. The district court declined to grant summary judgment here, right?
No, they granted summary judgment.
And so the question is, assuming you're not entitled to qualified immunity or that we're not going to take it up, one of the two, I know you think that'd be a terrible thing. Why did the district court err in granting summary judgment? And don't tell me because it should have granted qualified immunity.
Okay, let me try to clarify. Okay, because what I think Your Honor is asking is whether or not that we violated the First Amendment. Is that the question Your Honor is asking? Whether or not the district court erred in determining that we violated the First Amendment?
And you're saying on the facts of this case, no reasonable finder of fact
right.
could find. Putting aside whether the law is clearly established or not. You're saying on the facts of this case, no reasonable finder of fact could find a First Amendment violation.
Correct, Your Honor.
Why?
Which I'd like to point out, though, is the first step in qualified immunity.
Well, no, it's actually not, because for the first step in qualified immunity is whether or not there's a constitutional violation. Right. The first step in summary judgment is whether the facts would allow somebody to find it.
Okay.
And so I'm trying to figure out why, in this case, the facts... would not allow a court to find
it. Let me go through. There's 3 points here. First, under the NEC regulations, Chaplain Calderon lacked the authority to grant him the religious diet he wanted because his sincere beliefs do not allow, it's not requesting a diet that conforms to his sincere beliefs. Second, Paul failed.
Isn't that a fact question? Whether or not the diet corresponds to his sincere beliefs?
No, we're not saying, it's not a fact question because he admits it. He admits it doesn't correspond to his religious beliefs. He says, repeatedly, he says, this does not correspond. This is my religious beliefs requires me to have fresh fruits and vegetables and fish. The diet he was seeking is a kosher diet, which has lots of meat on it. Kosher diets have lots of meat on it. They have all kinds of things that are on it. He's not requesting a diet that meets with his religious beliefs. He's saying that I want this diet because I think it best suits my religious beliefs. So that's not a fact question. He is not asking for a diet that comports with his religious beliefs. He's asking for a diet that does not comport. And so what we're saying is what he has to show is that he has a diet, okay, under this court's decisions. He has to show that the diet we were providing him, which is an alternative meatless diet, without the foods that he considers offends his beliefs, does not meet his dietary, will not sustain him in good health. While, and additionally, he has to show that the kosher diet, without the foods that offends his beliefs, would sustain him in good health. That's his burden that he has to prove. He has not met that burden. He has no evidence to meet any of that. And therefore, his claim fails on that ground, too, because he can't show a substantial burden to his religious beliefs. Third, Paul failed to meet his burden of showing that NDOC lacked a legitimate penological reason for declining to provide Paulo with a diet that did not meet his religious beliefs as required by Turner. So those are the three points that I have to do with this.
Can you go back to his actual exercise claims as opposed to his free exercise claims? I think we all agree, I think we should agree that Ninth Circuit law says you measure exhaustion at the time that the operative complaint is filed. And the district court didn't do that. It measured exhaustion at the time of the original complaint. Why isn't that sufficient for us to send it back?
Well, first two reasons is one, and I don't know if I'm going to anger Your Honor, but my first response would be is because he's entitled to qualified immunity. Because okay. We're entitled to qualified immunity.
You didn't make me angry, but don't spend more time on it.
And then I would refer your honors to the to this court's decision that says when you're affirming rather than reversing, okay, you're required. You're in that case, there is a case that says you are mandated to affirm for any grounds that are in the record, regardless of whether or not, and you're not supposed to send it back.
So if you're going to insist on talking about qualified immunity, I guess I'll ask you some qualified immunity questions. What about Allen? The allegation here is that I think there was a 6-week period in which he got no outdoor exercise time at all. Allen is also a 6-week period, and I think he had 45 minutes there. It seems pretty close to the facts of Allen. Why doesn't that clearly establish?
No, because of what Your Honor pointed out in Norbert. Norbert distinguishes all these cases, and I think that's an important thing to look at. Is that Norbert says, hey, these cases didn't say you have an obligation. In fact, it says specifically that there is no constitutional right to outdoor exercise in Norbert.
Well, there's no per se. Norbert says that deprivation of outdoor exercise is not a per se constitutional violation if you have alternative indoor recreation. But taking the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, what is there in the record here that would suggest that he had that sort of adequate indoor alternative? So the question is, what can you point me to that shows that that he had the sort of indoor alternatives that Norbert says are okay?
The record is replete with it. I mean, when he's responding to his grievances, if you look at those responses, it talks about how many hours he's given on tier, which is what the court Norbert pointed out. He said, hey, in the Fifth Circuit case, the Fifth Circuit found that, hey, having 1 hour a day on tier was sufficient. And he had more than 1 hour a day on tier. He had more, in fact, he had recreational opportunities, would say, all pointed out that he had visitation rights. This is not the case where these cases they stopped relying on. These cases are relying on where the prisoner is in lockdown 24 hours a day in his cell, and therefore he needs to have outdoor exercise. He has no outdoor recreation opportunities. But when this court in Norbert says...
Are you saying on tier time if I understood opposing counsel's argument, the on-tier time included all their time to engage in a variety of life activities. It wasn't just exercise time.
Right, you're right.
Were there facilities for exercise, indoor exercise, that are meaningfully comparable to outdoor? And how much of that time would have to be spent on, eating, using the restroom, whatever it may be, other activities, religious exercise?
There's gym time. There's time for visitation. There's time to go to meals. There's time that he doesn't count when he's walking back and forth outdoors to go to the yard. It's replete that he has clearly established, in the record, that he has more than enough time. I know they pointed out one time in the reply brief, they said, well, he was in lockdown. But if you look at that quote that they talk about where he says that he was in lockdown, it says, I'm currently in lockdown. He doesn't say how long he was in lockdown. He doesn't say that he was in lockdown for 6 weeks. There is no evidence in the record that he was ever in lockdown for that time of period of time, which would say that he had no outdoor exercise.
Okay, so you don't have to, but if you want to reserve time for rebuttal on the cross appeal, you may, or you can keep going now.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. I will reserve time.
Okay. Ms. Enloe.
Good morning, Your Honors. Madeline Enloe from Pepperdine Law, representing the appellate, Mr. Palo. I'd like to begin by addressing the merits of the free exercise claim. The district court correctly ruled that the defendants violated Mr. Palo's free exercise rights. The First Amendment prohibits any substantial burden on a prisoner's exercise of religion unless that burden is reasonably related to legitimate penological interests. The defendants failed to meet this burden at the summary judgment stage.
But the district court never addressed qualified immunity.
No, Your Honor, but we believe that the defendants are not entitled to qualified immunity.
I think you may make a compelling case about that, and the other side may have one too. But isn't the district court supposed to do that when the other party asserts it as a defense?
Your Honor, at the most, this court could send it down to discuss the qualified immunity issue, but as to the merits, we do believe that they presented no evidence sufficient to overturn summary judgment in their favor at this time.
Well, I wanted you to address separately the factual issue about summary judgment. I'm just concerned. The Supreme Court said any number of times, don't just run right to the constitutional violation of this. Figure out whether there's qualified immunity. And they say there is, you say there isn't because you're not seeking damages, et cetera. Doesn't a district court at least have the obligation to treat that argument?
Your Honor, I'm not sure about the obligation with that, but this court could address it as well and agree with us to find that he did not, the qualified immunity doesn't.
You all want us to do extra work, aren't you?
Yes, Your Honor. But regardless, we, as you mentioned, we do believe that the defendants are not entitled to qualified immunity on this issue because Mr. Palo cited numerous cases that put the prison officials on notice of their unconstitutional conduct, including this court's decision in Shakur versus Shariro, which is very similar to the case here. And in that case, the court held that denying a prisoner his requested diet was in violation of his sincerely held religious beliefs and violated the free exercise clause, even though that plaintiff himself was not required to eat that diet as his religion, but believed it necessary for his own personal practice.
Is there a fact question about whether or not this diet is required by his sincerely held religious beliefs? Your friend says, at least there's evidence in the record that he's just looking for food that he likes better than what he would be served otherwise.
No, Your Honor, we do not believe there's a dispute in that. Mr. Palo stated that he sincerely believed the common fare diet was the best way for him to practice his religion, and it was necessary for his religious exercise.
Is there, and I understand it doesn't have to be an established religion, but it does seem like that his religion is, in this case, is essentially, I would like to eat this stuff. Is there some other evidence that he sincerely holds a belief that this is a religiously required exercise?
Yes, Your Honor. Excuse me, sorry. Your Honor, yes. But there is evidence to that. Mr. Palo stated that he needed to consume a nature-based diet consisting of nuts, grains, vegetables, and fish to practice Buddhism. And in 4 ER 535, Mr. Palo stated that all of those are contained in the common fare diet, and that was the best diet for him to practice his religious exercise. While the record does not provide precise details as to the alternative meatless diet, which was what he was automatically provided and was requesting the Common Fare diet in replacement of, we can presume that an alternative meatless diet would not include fish, which he believed he needed to best practice his religious exercise. And while Buddhism does not require its adherents to have that specific diet, the prison's own policy does require that Buddhists have this alternative meatless diet and supplement their own views in place of Mr. Palo's beliefs for what he needed to practice his own religious beliefs. So we do not believe it is a mere preference, Your Honor. We believe this was necessary for his religious exercise. For Palo, he has stated that the diet is a spiritual act, and the prison's outright denial of the Common Fare diet forced Mr. Palo to completely abandon the diet aspect of his religion and prevented him from exercising this central tenet. And on that, the defendants have not, excuse me, Your Honor, the defendants have not pointed to any evidence contrary to overturned summary judgment, and we do not believe they are entitled to qualified immunity. And Your Honor, circling back to the exhaustion issue, Sadezai made clear that litigants do not need to file a new federal case simply because they had not exhausted at the time in which they filed their original federal complaint. The time of exhaustion can be continued from the amended complaint, and that is the date to look at. And the district court committed error by looking not at the date of the amended complaint, but at the date of the operative complaint. Your Honor, if you have any more questions, I see my time is running low.
It appears not.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. We respectfully ask that this court reverse the district court's judgment on the Eighth Amendment claim and affirm the district court's judgment on the First Amendment claim. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right, Mr. Davis, rebuttal on the cross-appeal.
And I'll try to be real brief. First of all, I'd like to talk about Sadezai because that was brought up before. And I would respectfully disagree that Sadezai says that it doesn't apply just to new claims. If you look actually at the facts of Sadezai, then you'll see that they only applied it to a new claim and not to an old claim, although the language appears to be more expansive than actually the facts of the case. But I think Your Honor should take a cue from Norbert. Norbert looked at exercise claims and said, hey, you know, if you actually look at the facts of these cases, you know, it's not holding exactly what people are claiming they hold about an absolute right to outdoor exercise. And I think Your Honor should take that that opportunity to do the same. Second of all, I'd like to point out one point about amending, because I did make a point about that you can't, that the amended complaint cannot be exhausted because it was improperly granted. The counsel on the other side in the reply brief brought up and said, hey, he could amend as a matter of right, and therefore the district court couldn't have denied the motion to amend. Well, that's not true, Honor, because he wasn't bringing an amended complaint. He was actually bringing a supplemental complaint under Rule 15D because he was adding facts that happened after the original complaint. And under Rule 15D, you cannot amend as a matter of right. The only way, according to this court's precedent, the only way you can amend under 15D is by getting a motion to amend. And because the district court erred in denying the motion to amend, they can't rely on the amended complaint to establish exhaustion. All the other arguments are in my briefs. I refer them to them and respectfully request that you grant judgment in favor of defendants on all claims.
Is it your position that the district court erred in granting the motion to amend, right? Yes?
Granting the motion to
you
amend.
You said denying, that's why I meant.
Oh, granting the motion to amend. Sorry, Your Honor.
Right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We thank all counsel for their arguments. And Ms. Newman and Ms. Enlow, you're representing Mr. Palo pro bono, and the court thanks you for your service. The case is submitted.